H.W. Bush, and this came up during the service, was someone who really cherished every day he was alive.
Tributes to the life of the 41st President of the United States. This is Thursday, December 6th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You're part of this program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, we find out more about the year the former president spent in China. Conflicting messaging leads to confusion and some worry about a possible U.S.-China trade agreement. And you'll hear about a proposed life partnership bill in Thailand, all on VOA Asia. The U.S. bade farewell Wednesday to its former president, George H.W. Bush, at a state funeral in Washington, attended by top American political figures along with current and former leaders from throughout the world. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was there. Steve, what happened?
Well, this was really a remarkable scene in the National Cathedral, where 94-year-old George Herbert Walker Bush was eulogized, including by his son, who was the 43rd president of the United States, George W. Bush, saying that his father had taught us public service was noble and necessary, and he had enormous capacity to give of himself. Now, Ira, we did not hear from the current president, Donald Trump. That was basically at the request of the late president and a break from recent tradition. But the president did tweet before the service that he was looking forward to it, and he said, "This is not a funeral. This is a day of celebration for a great man who has led a long and distinguished life. He will be missed." Of course, it was a funeral, a state funeral, and the first time we've seen this for a president in a dozen years. And it was a very interesting scene, Ira, when the president and the first lady came into the cathedral, and there already in the first rows were former presidents of the United States, including Trump's immediate predecessor, Barack Obama. The president did reach out to his predecessor. They shook hands. But really, the tension was palpable in the first row of those pews, and we really did not see Trump and Obama speak after that.
You know, it really was a celebration in many ways, and there were some very lighthearted and funny moments.
Right. One of the speakers at this service was a former U.S. senator from the state of Wyoming, Alan Simpson, who really was a close friend of President Bush and socialized with him, and he told some jokes and said that his friend was a class act from birth to death, and eulogized him as one of nature's noble men. And we also heard from a presidential historian, John Meacham. And of course, this was somebody that the late president wanted to speak at this service. And he hailed George H.W. Bush as America's last great soldier statesman, someone who made our lives and the lives of nations freer, better, nobler, and warmer. And that international aspect to the Bush presidency was very much on display. Former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, also one of the people giving a eulogy, and some of the other dignitaries inside the cathedral from overseas, Prince Charles of Britain, the King and Queen of Jordan, the current German Chancellor, the Polish President, and former presidents from several countries, as well as former prime ministers from such countries as Britain and Japan and Kuwait.
You know, what was really apparent watching the service was how much love was shown to this man.
You know, George H.W. Bush, and this came up during the service, was someone who really cherished every day he was alive.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, thanks so much. More on the time George H.W. Bush spent in China. This is VOA Asia. Among the top stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com, Pakistan's prime minister renews his resolve to cooperate with the United States to achieve a political settlement with the Taliban to end the war in Afghanistan. Indonesian human rights groups decry the arrest made of West Papuan students and pro-independence activists after they staged peaceful rallies across the Indonesian cities on Saturday. Global stock prices fell Wednesday, though not as much as Wall Street the day before, amid confusion about what the U.S. and China agreed to in a tariff ceasefire. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We continue now on VOA Asia. Yesterday, we told you about George H.W. Bush's year in China in the mid-70s. We continue that conversation now with Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He and Bush compiled a diary the former president wrote during his time in Beijing. I asked Engel about the Bush's impression of the Chinese people.
Oh, he had a wonderful, time there. You're really hard-pressed as a biographer of George Bush to find a moment in his life where he didn't make friends or didn't have a good time. It's just his natural disposition. So when he was there, he actually spent a lot of time trying to learn Chinese. Barber did a better job, to be completely frank, and really spent a lot of time trying to get out and talk to Chinese people as much as he could. Now, again, there was a huge language barrier, and of course not as many Chinese spoke English in 1974 as do today in Beijing. So it was really more of a show-and-tell relationship that he would walk around with his Polaroid camera, for example, something that was rarely seen, if ever, by the average Chinese citizen, take pictures and then give people the pictures. There's a part of me that feels like I need to explain what a Polaroid camera is at this point, you know, a camera that can actually instantly produce a picture. And that was basically the greatest icebreaker he found. Everywhere he went, he could go up to a crowd, give them a take pictures, give them a picture, and he thought that way they would learn that Americans were nothing to be feared.
When did he get tired of it, if he did?
He would have stayed longer. He winds up coming back. President Ford did a general broad reorganization of his entire cabinet and brought Bush back to be director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And that was really at the moment where Bush, I think, would have stayed longer, but had gotten what he needed to out of China, which is to say what he really needed at that point was a new, different experience that wasn't embroiled in Watergate and wasn't embroiled in Washington, D.C. So he left essentially at what would we look what he would look back in retrospect and say was exactly the right time, though when he got the news that he was going to leave, he didn't want to go. He didn't want to go because he was having a good time. And also, he didn't want to go because nobody had really ever gone into the intelligence community as the head of the CIA and then continued afterwards with a political career. And he thought that this was going to be the end of his political career, but he also thought, as a good public servant, that if the president asks you to do something, the answer is yes. So he goes back to Washington, but really left China with wonderful feelings because he'd never, if you will, grown tired of it.
I was reading some of the information that he had written dealing with the diaries, and he mentioned that he might have spent too much time on the great hot dog bun crisis of 1975. What's that all about?
Well, this is a good example of the way that Bush, because he thought about personal relations and he thought about friendly relations being important to create good diplomatic relations, he wanted to throw a big 4th of July party like every other embassy in the world did. It's a traditional 4th of July party, bring people in, bring the diplomatic corps. Every nation, to be honest, has sort of a national celebration day, and usually the ambassadors for different countries will open their homes on that day. And Bush wanted to do the same, and of course, he wanted to serve American food. Well, what could be more American than hot dogs? It was not easy in 1974 to find enough hot dogs and enough Coca-Cola, and more importantly, to get it into Beijing for the embassy to have a proper cookout. But he did. And of course, you know, the amount of beer they had, that they could get, that made the event fun no matter what. But at the very least, he was really trying to show people what a good old-fashioned Texas 4th of July would look like.
What was your relationship with him?
You know, I had a completely wonderful and unexpected pleasure throughout my career of being able to work closely with him as a historian. I never worked for him, but I worked next to him. So I edited his China diary, which is what we're discussing, of course. And during that process, met with him numerous times, interviewed him numerous times, actually went to Beijing with him in 2005 to he and Barbara to essentially, they were there for a conference. But we spent time essentially thinking about their memories from their period there in the 70s. And then subsequently, when I continued to work on his presidency again as a historian, he was very gracious and very open and really never refused an interview request and was wonderfully accessible. And I think what's really key about that, and I can't stress this enough, and I wish more people in power would think about it hard, Bush recognized that the people who do history and the people who write history have fundamentally different jobs, and they need to work together, but the people who do history have no claim over influencing the people who write history. Basically, you don't get to control what people say in the future. And I had every confidence in the world that President Bush would never be, even if he disagreed, would never be critical of my interpretation, because I never showed him my interpretation until after it was published. And that was really key. And he never, ever asked to see any interpretation until after the book was already in press.
So what does this country lose with his passing?
It loses, I think, two things that are critical. The first is really there's a generational shift that we have to recognize, that Bush was the last of the World War II presidents to serve in office. And consequently, his passing means is representative of the general passing of that generation. More importantly, I think Bush really represents a more civil moment in American politics. And I have to be critical here as a historian to note the politics and the incivility that we see today are nothing new. The politics of the 1850s, for example, were perhaps even bloodier and uglier than they were today. But at the very least, throughout the second half of the 20th century, throughout the end of the Cold War period, there really was a general consensus that even if you were a Democrat or Republican, you could reach across the aisle and still think of the other person as a patriotic American. Bush was, I think, really the last president to both enjoy that privilege and also to embody that privilege, which is to say, whether you were a Democrat or a Republican, there were really very few people in the country when he was president who thought of him as illegitimate, that he shouldn't be there. They might disagree with his policies, but they still respected his right to hold the office. We've not seen a president enjoy that from the American people since, and that's a real shame. I think ultimately what is really important about George Bush as a diplomat is that he practiced what I like to call Hippocratic diplomacy, which is something he also learned in China. Hippocratic, you know, from the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, which is to say whenever Bush faced major crises, and I would argue he faced more major crises during his time in office than any other president in history on the international front, with the possible exception of Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. Whenever Bush faced an international crisis, the first thing he did was do nothing in a cognitive way. He would sit back and say, what's going on? What can we do that's not going to make things worse? You know, he didn't go out in front of the microphones and scream and yell. He didn't tweet. He didn't have the ability, but I guarantee you he wouldn't have if he had been had Twitter at the time. And he handled things quietly behind the scenes with personal phone calls to foreign leaders to make sure that the international crises of his day did not get bigger. And really, I think if you think history is going in the right direction, as Bush did, in a democratic direction, any crisis you can keep from blowing up, if you will, is a crisis that you will successfully complete in the end.
Jeffrey Engel, I thank you so much for doing this. Happening now in Asia, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the military alliance remains committed to restoring peace in Afghanistan despite rising Afghan casualties and repeated delays to begin peace talks. Stoltenberg told reporters today after the two-day NATO ministerial meeting in Brussels that together we'll reaffirm our commitment to Afghanistan's long-term security and stability. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Conflicting White House messaging about a reported breakthrough on U.S.-Chinese trade disputes, coupled with relative silence from Beijing, left many American lawmakers unsure where precisely trade matters stand between the two economic giants. For days, President Donald Trump has hailed agreements he says he reached with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, at the G20 summit in Argentina, from a 90-day deferment of additional tariffs on each other's exports to a Chinese commitment to purchase U.S. agricultural products to a reduction of China's duties on American automobiles. Virginia Senator Mark Warner said he wouldn't be surprised if Trump was simply making things up about a U.S.-China trade deal to try to get a single day of good press stories. Trump's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, backs the president's claim of a good relationship with Xi, but looking ahead, he would only say the groundwork is in place for trade agreements between China and the United States.
I don't want to throw a damper into this, but China has discussed these things with the U.S. many times down through the years, and the results have not been very good. So this time around, as I said, I'm hopeful we're covering more ground than ever. They are more cooperative than ever.
Without giving any details, Chinese officials say they are confident in implementing trade commitments made to the U.S. as soon as possible. Again, they gave no details. Coming up, Thailand's government considers the proposed life partnership bill. This is VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A powerful earthquake that struck in the southern Pacific Ocean on Wednesday sent jitters around the region after authorities warned of possible tsunamis. But there were no initial reports of destructive waves or any major damage. A magnitude 7.5 quake hit in the afternoon near the French territory of New Caledonia at a shallow depth where earthquakes are generally more damaging. This is VOA Asia. In Thailand, same-sex partnership laws remain limited but are changing as the government considers the proposed life partnership bill, which would guarantee gay couples many rights similar to traditional marriages. Steve Sanford talks to a same-sex couple and activist about the effects of the new bill.
Visitors to Thailand might get the impression that the country is tolerant towards lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, the LGBT community. But for some, intolerance still exists, and the same-sex partnership law is seen as a milestone.
We have problems with the family. They don't accept who we are because Thailand is not as open as Western countries. Now we have the law, and our families have heard about it, and they are starting to open their hearts for us. It will help get our lives back to normal.
LGBT groups are holding public hearings and rallies across the country ahead of a government decision. It's a move that caught the attention of Patapan and his partner Patawi, who live together in the northern capital of Chiang Mai.
In the past, when we first lived together, we had to pretend to live like others and pretend that we were just friends. When we went out in public, we didn't dare hold our hands to show our affection. Things are changing now because we have more support and we aren't afraid to hold our hands in public.
The bill was first introduced in 2013 and was on its way to becoming law when a military coup sidelined it. Now, Thailand could be the first Asian country to legally recognize same-sex partnership rights, as open discussions are once again welcome, or at least tolerated.
We open the public hearing stage for every group, for LGBTs, for the government that has to implement the law if it's passed. We discuss the challenges and limitations that we will have if passed and what we need to do to make the law work best in our society.
Gay rights groups say the bill is a positive step, but they will continue to push, hoping that the law is a sign of more rights to follow.
For the latest same-sex marriage law, they need more adjustments and changes to make it more complete for the LGBT group. For example, when a partner gets sick, we can sign the documents for his treatment and for adoption to allow us to adopt children.
Steve Sanford for VOA News in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
this news alert from VOA Asia. Germany's top official for human rights was due to visit Tibet Wednesday for a dialogue with Chinese counterparts after being denied permission to visit the heavily policed northwestern region of Xinjiang. German Human Rights Commissioner Barbel Koffler said in a statement she had wanted to travel to Xinjiang, where an estimated 1 million members of the Uyghur minority have been held in political re-education camps. Now on VOA Asia, a massive protest by farmers in the Indian capital has turned the spotlight on growing rural distress in that country. Farmers say many have been driven into debt because agriculture is no longer profitable. The deepening anger among India's rural community could hurt Prime Minister Narendra Modi in next year's elections. More than half the country of 1.3 billion people depends on farming, and they're an important voting bloc. Anjana Prasricha met one group of protesting farmers in New Delhi.
During a brief halt as they marched into Delhi, these angry farmers explained what brought them from across the country.
We don't even get the fruits of our labor that the family puts in on the farm, slogging day and night.
That grievance is echoed by all protesters.
I got very little money when I went to sell my rice crop. How will I earn? We're making a loss.
The protesters say farm incomes have plunged as produce prices have failed to keep pace with the soaring costs of key supplies such as fertilizers.
For a large number of them, for a majority of them, the income is probably less than $50 a month. That's the level at which they survive. And one of the principal reasons for that is that they don't get enough price for their crops.
That is not the only problem. Increasingly, erratic weather patterns pose a new challenge. Nearly half of India's farmers lack access to irrigation.
There has been very little rain this year. My crops have been ruined. There have been successive droughts, and we now face a massive problem.
Many farmers have said they want to quit.
I will give up farming and go to Calcutta and look for work to make a living. There is no money to be earned from the farm.
Protests by farmers have intensified as they try to draw attention to the usually forgotten countryside. This was their fourth and biggest march to Delhi this year. In June, they threw their produce on the streets to highlight low prices. Although the rural crisis has been festering, economists say a sweeping currency ban 2 years ago aggravated farmers' distress.
Many farmers lost working capital. They had to borrow money from the banks or from the local money lenders at high interest rate. So the costs went up. So if costs go up and incomes come down, revenue comes down, then income gets squeezed. This government promised that we'll double farm incomes in 5 years, but it's far from there.
The farmers are demanding a special session of parliament to discuss two demands: better produce prices and a government waiver from repaying bank loans.
Farmers are saying, okay, enough is enough. Now something really needs to be done.
With general elections just months away, Prime Minister Narendra Modi has very little time to placate the angry farmers who marched down Delhi's streets. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is Science in a Minute.
Archaeologists conducting a dig at an ancient Italian cemetery have found the skeletal remains of a 10-year-old child that suggested a so-called vampire burial. The remains included a skull with a rock intentionally placed into the mouth in what was described as a possible religious or superstitious effort to prevent the deceased from rising from the dead. According to the researchers, the cemetery where the remains were found was used to bury babies and young children back in the 5th century. It's thought that the youngsters may have died in an outbreak of malaria that swept the Italian region of Umbria at that time. The archaeologists say that they believe placing the stone into the child's mouth may have been part of a funeral ritual designed to contain the disease as well as the body itself. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you so much for giving us some of your time to listen to us at VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook, also our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, Our engineer, John Ellison, managing editor, Diane Gao, VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.